In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Your ideas aren't worthy of discussion and are so dangerous, there are creepy informants posing as journalists writing for major corporate-owned press outlets. Glenn Greenwald describes them as an unholy mix of junior high hall monitor tattling and Stasi-like citizen surveillance, who spend their days trolling the depths of chat rooms and private communications to find anyone influential or obscure who is saying something they believe should be forbidden. Well, as many know, this is part of the Big Reset goal. And speaking of dangerous ideas, we hear an interview with Eustace Mullins about his book Murder by Injection, the story of medical conspiracy against America. You will hear him reference how fluoride in the water causes cancer. In the book, he also quotes a doctor who said, "I've had to deal with at least 200 cases of cancer. I never saw a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person." Eustace Mullins is being interviewed here by independent talk show host Bobby Lee. Mullins was a native of Virginia and a descendant of William Mullins, whose name is on the Mayflower Compact, a government code written for the Mayflower settlers and the first compact written in the New World. He served 38 months in the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II. Eustace was educated at Washington and Lee University, Ohio State University, the University of North Dakota, New York University, and the Institute of Contemporary Arts, Washington, D.C. And here is an excerpt from the foreword of Murder by Injection. "The cynicism and malice of these conspirators is something beyond the imagination of most Americans. They deliberately mulct our people of millions of dollars each year through charitable organizations and then use these same organizations as key groups to bolster their medical monopoly. Fear and intimidation are the basic techniques by which the conspirators maintain their control over all aspects of our healthcare, as they ruthlessly crush any competitor who challenges their profits. As in other aspects of their behavioral control over the American people, their most constantly used weapon against us is their employment of federal agents and federal agencies to carry out their intrigues. The proof of this operation may be the most disturbing revelation of my work." Let's go now to hear that interview with Eustace Mullins about his book, Murder by Injection.
We have this book that Eustace Mullins wrote. It's called Murder by Injection: The Story of the American Medical Conspiracy Against America, against you and I. So it's Murder by Injection. Eustace Mullins, we're happy to have you with us today. Tell us a little bit about how did you come to write this book, Murder by Injection?
Well, I had been working for almost a half a century on the various monopolies, the legal monopoly, the banking monopoly, the secret government monopoly of the world. And I realized that all of these monopolies interacted, and about the same group of elitists, the world order people, were in each one. But I had not paid much attention to the medical profession. I thought, well, these are doctors who are curing people. They work in the hospital long hours, you know, and they're probably a public asset. And I thought that simply because I hadn't had any contact with them. Fortunately for me. And other people who have had contact with them had a different view. Either they were furious or they were disgusted or they were dead. And so this was the status of the people who employed the medical profession in the United States, the average American citizen. And the doctors, during this period, as part of the drug trust and the medical monopoly, had various instruments furnished to them by the other monopolies. For instance, the oil monopoly of John D. Rockefeller at Standard Oil had gone into petrochemical business, and through extensive research, they had developed certain medications, which they called wonder drugs, and the public, as they took these drugs, they would wonder what was going to happen to them. That's why they were wonder drugs. Others were called miracle drugs. They were called miracle drugs because if you took them and you survived, it was really a miracle. So this was the contribution of the monopolists to the medical monopoly. And the only thing that these drugs had in common was that they were enormously expensive. Now, in contrast, most of nature's remedies are enormously inexpensive. They're available, they're abundant, they're cheap, which means that the medical monopoly did not want you to use any of these medications. They wanted the greatest achievement of the modern drug trust was the invention of the $1,000 pill. They have now they have one pill which costs $1,000, which you use in cancer and various things. And nature, unfortunately, has never learned how to make a $1,000 pill. So obviously, nature is no good as far as the medical monopoly is concerned.
Well, tell us a little bit, just before we get into that also, there's a difference between homeopathic medicine and allopathic, and that's part of what we're discussing also. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, Eustace Mullins.
Well, what you're talking about is a historic situation. In the 19th century, most Americans thrived on what is called homeopathic medicine, which is mostly naturopathic remedies available through nature in abundance at low cost. Well, the medical monopoly, which was formed in 1847 as the American Medical Association, they didn't like this. They thought, how are doctors going to get rich, and how are we going to control the people through the medical monopoly when they can go to these homeopathic people and get these remedies at very low cost? So the first plank of the AMA was, we will never allow any homeopathic physician to become a member of the AMA, and they never have. So, but the AMA was still in a minority. So around the turn of the century, John D. Rockefeller realized there were great potentialities of profit in the medical industry. And so he took over the medical profession. Now you say, how could anybody take over the medical profession? Well, first you have to have a lot of money, and second you have a lot of power. Well, he had both, and he did. So he revamped the entire medical system of treatment of the people of the United States, which had been homeopathic. He switched it over to allopathic medicine, which is a different type of practice originating in Germany. And the great attraction of allopathic medicine is it relies on radical surgery. I mean, if you can't cure it, cut it off. And the heavy use of drugs, because when you're having your limbs cut off, you need a lot of drugs because it's very disturbing. And lengthy hospital stays, none of which are features of homeopathic medicine. It's entirely the reverse. So by taking over the medical industry in 1910, through studies which he made through the Carnegie Foundation, John D. Rockefeller emerged as the kingpin of the medical monopoly in the United States. And he now presided over an allopathic system of medicine controlled through every legislature by accreditation of hospitals, control of physicians, control of medications, and which is essentially what we have today. So from 1910, when this change was effected, right to the present day, the cost of health care has multiplied astronomically in the United States to the point where it is no longer available to most American citizens. So how did they counteract this? When they got us to the point where the average working man could not afford hospital care or the allopathic system of treatment, they set up an insurance industry, medical insurance. And through this, they were able to spread out the costs among everybody. And health insurance today is simply another tax on the American people. In fact, it functions through the Social Security system as a tax on the recipients of Social Security. They say, well, now that you've reached your senior citizen stank, you have Social Security coming in, so then they jerk back a good portion of it as Medicare costs, which they raise every year. And so eventually, probably, Social Security and Medicare will be equal, so you'll get a check every month, which will be zero, zero, zero. They say, well, here's your Social Security check, but we've deducted your Medicare costs, and so now you get zero.
And it's funneled into the Rockefeller-style monopoly, whoever is involved in it.
All of the money from the health industry goes into the medical monopoly and the drug trust. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the Rockefellers control every major drug company in the world. And now, when I say control, I mean directly. They have, among the directors and officials of each of the 18 largest drug companies in the world, they have men from Chase Manhattan Bank, from the Exxon oil company, and so forth. So they're right there, the names. I have all their names in my book, Murder by Injection. And with this kind of control and the monopoly, they have been jacking up the health costs on the American people monthly, not yearly, but monthly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it $666 billion last year, that was a lot of money for this country to spend on health, and we're spending twice what many of the free world countries are spending. Japan and Germany, we're almost spending twice. And you say that this is part of the monopoly, and that's part of the reason that we're spending so much?
Well, actually, we're not spending it. The money's being stolen. Mm-hmm. The Washington Post carried a story not long ago in which they pointed out that the hospitals and the AMA physicians, and I'm not talking about quacks or cranks or fly-by-night people, I'm talking about the medical establishment, is stealing directly $77 billion a year in health costs from the American people. And does the Washington Post offer any solution to this? No, they say by 1995, the amount of theft will be more than $100 billion a year, stolen directly, plus all the other money that they get.
That's, ladies and gentlemen, that's why we're $4 trillion in debt. That's part of it anyway. So let's talk about the Hippocratic Oath, or maybe the Hypocrite's Oath, and Galen and Dr. Robert Mendelsohn. But what about the profits of cancer? Let's go into that, Eustace. How has cancer become profitable for people?
Well, you see, the medical industry, just like any other industry, they go for the big-ticket item, and cancer is a big-ticket item. I think the average cost of treating cancer is $120,000. And the interesting thing about it is when you go to a doctor and he says, oh, you have cancer, and he says, I really can't do anything for you, but I'm going to give you a lot of treatment. It's going to cost you a lot of money and a lot of pain. Your hair is going to fall out. You're going to wish you were dead, and sooner or later you will be. But meanwhile, we'll get all your money. This is called cancer treatment in the United States.
The how did this start? How did this come about? Let's talk about radium before, because I think radium was one of the first cures, supposedly. Who developed the radium treatments? And tell us a little bit about that, if you would, Eustace Mullins.
Well, you know, there's a Frankenstein, a Dr. Frankenstein aspect to modern medicine, where you have all of these mysterious machines throwing out various beams of light and radiation and so forth. And the person who's doing this, of course, is hopelessly insane. And when you go into modern treatment, you pretty much find that you're in a Frankenstein environment.
And you have to be pretty much insane to
well,
participate.
You wish you were insane, because if you're still conscious, it's pretty hard to endure what they put you through. And modern cancer treatment originated with a doctor from South Carolina named Sims. And Dr. Sims apparently was just a common run-of-the-mill sadist. And he liked to operate on people, not because he wanted to cure anything, but just to be cutting them up and, you know, having good, clean fun. And so the people in South Carolina, after they got onto him, they wouldn't let him touch them anymore. So he was reduced. He had to go and buy a slave girl. This was before the Civil War. He had to buy a slave girl for $500 so that he could cut her up. And then the people in the area were so outraged by what he was doing that they ran him out of town. So he went to New York, where his peculiarities would be less obvious. And he started a cancer hospital up there, and which was called Women's Hospital. And this was financed by a very wealthy lady named Melissa Phelps Dodge, of the Phelps Dodge fortune, a great mining fortune. And so he ran this hospital for a while. And again, the rumors started to creep out that there was a lot of torture and sadism going on in this hospital. I mean, he didn't give up all of his fun just because he went to New York. That's where you go to have fun. And so he was going great guns. And so everybody at the hospital rebelled and said, get rid of Dr. Sims or we aren't coming back here anymore. Well, his wealthy patron, you know, they don't like for their lackeys to be criticized. So she ignored them all, and he continued. And this hospital later became a memorial hospital, and then it was financed by a relative of hers named James S. Douglas of the Phelps Dodge Mining Corporation, and he was called the Copper King. Well, in his mining interests in Arizona, he had come across a lot of uranium, which he also mined, and he became fascinated with the possibilities of radium as a treatment of various diseases. So he experimented on his wife and daughter until they both died of radium poisoning, and he continued to experiment on himself, and he also died of radium poisoning. And so Memorial Hospital then was continued. The fact that all these people had died didn't discourage the doctors at all. I mean, the fact that the treatment kills you never has discouraged any doctor yet. And in fact, they say, well, he got a lot of relief, didn't he? And so then it became slow. From Memorial Hospital, the name changed to Sloan Kettering after the great two automobile manufacturers, Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors and Charles Kettering, who invented the battery and the electrical system of the automobile. And their fortune was funneled into this Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, which became the center of cancer treatment of the entire world. I call it the Cancer Mausoleum there in New York City. And it looks like an old Egyptian mausoleum. So even though it had the names of Sloan Kettering on it, it was taken over entirely by the Rockefellers. Lawrence Rockefeller's on the board, and various of their people from Chase Manhattan Bank. When you read, and I have the list of directors of Sloan Kettering in my book, each one of them has a direct Rockefeller connection. All the cancer treatment in the United States stems from the work done at Sloan Kettering. And it's still principally based on radiation and on chemotherapy and radical surgery. And in fact, they had one treatment there which consisted of chopping the whole lower part of the body off on the theory that that would stop cancer. Well, everyone they tried this treatment on died, so
stop cancer, right?
Well, they say the operation was successful, but the patient died. That's modern medicine. And like they say, you lose a few and you win a few.
Right.
Anyway, Sloan Kettering is the great cancer hospital, and the fact that it goes back to this lunatic named Dr. Sims doesn't bother them one bit.
Well, tell us a little bit about the difference today. What is chemotherapy, and can chemotherapy be helpful under certain circumstances?
Well, the theory behind all cancer treatment of the medical monopoly and the drug trust is that you destroy the offending cell. A cancer cell is a cell which supposedly has run amok and begins to grow wildly throughout the body, and it shuts off normal cells and kills them, and that's how you die of cancer. Well, this approach, which is strictly allopathic, says you've got to destroy that offending cell through radiation, and you burn it out, which means you burn up everything around it also, but that doesn't discourage anybody. And secondly, through chemotherapy, you find some very strong chemical which can be injected into the body. It'll go right to the offending cell and destroy it, and of course it also destroys everything around it. Now, the homeopathic cure for cancer is restore the immune system. In other words, the body can control cancer through its own native resources, its inner resources of isolating the offending cells and then destroying them or letting them starve. But actually, all allopathic remedies for cancer actually encourage the cancer. For instance, they always make exploratory surgery. Well, in cancer, once you cut anywhere in the flesh, the cancer will go throughout the entire body. The cancer cells just say, boy, what an opportunity. We can go everywhere now through this surgery, and so they do. So that's why they say in cancer treatment, oh, they opened him up and looked at him and said it's hopeless and sewed him back up. And that's exactly what happens, because once you cut into a cancer patient, he's gone anyway. So one of the great causes of the spread of cancer in the United States is our exposure to carcinogenic systems, mainly chemicals and pollutions in the air. So the allopathic system, the Rockefeller system of controlling cancer, once you have introduced carcinogenic substances into the system and you began to have cancer, then their solution is to introduce even more carcinogenic substances into the system, which they call chemotherapy. And of course the patients die there too. And the great illustration of the success of chemotherapy was a very famous senator, Hubert Humphrey, who had been vice president, and he developed bladder cancer. And so they treated him for about a year and a half, and they said, what a great success it is that we're having with Senator Humphrey with chemotherapy. So then Hubert Humphrey finally was interviewed, and he said, chemotherapy is living death, and he died. So that's the only real illustration they ever had of the success of chemotherapy. And he denounced it, he had breath enough to denounce it before he died, because he had really been through misery like no human being should ever be subjected to. But not only do you have carcinogenic substances and pollution, but you also, a lot of the spread of cancer is due to the fluoridation of the water in our public supplies, which of course was done through the Chase Manhattan Bank and the Alco Aluminum Trust. And not many Americans realize that the water systems of our major cities were fluoridated in the 1950s because the head of the Public Health Service was Oscar Ewing, a former chairman of the Democratic National Commission, who was then giving a high-paying job in Washington of the Federal Security Agency, under which the Department of Health and Human Services functioned. And he had been a former attorney for the Aluminum Corporation of America, and they had this problem of disposing of the sodium fluoride, a byproduct of the manufacture of aluminum. It was very expensive. It was probably the most dangerous toxic substance known in the United States. And so they said, we've got to dispose of this somehow less expensively. And someone came up with the notion, and I call it a notion because there's never been any evidence for it, that if you put sodium fluoride in the water and a child under the age of 8 drank it, he would never have any cavities. So we got to do anything to help the little children, so they fluoridated all of the water of our cities. But then a congressman named Adolph Miller went on the floor of Congress March 27, 1952, and he gave a different story. He said, there are no studies which show that sodium fluoride does anything for anybody. But he said, I did find that Oscar Ewing received a $775,000 bribe from the Aluminum Corporation of America to enforce sodium fluoride fluoridation of water in every major city in the United States. So you're drinking fluoridated water not because it helps your children's teeth, but because a federal official took a $775,000 bribe. This is the way things are done in Washington.
Medicine is big business, right?
Medicine is big business, and it pays well if you're in the right position at the right time. So Oscar Ewing took his bribe. He went to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he developed one of the biggest office complexes in the South, which is now filled with government offices since he was head of the Democratic National Commission. It's called the Triangle Research Corporation, and it made him and his family wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. That $775,000 was parlayed into a $50 million research center, owned entirely by the recipient of this bribe. So he got the research center, and we got the fluoridation. And the fluoridated water, one of the effects of this on the human system is it damages the immune system. In other words, your immune system, if you have been drinking fluoridated water over a period of time, 2 years or 10 years or so what, it loses its effectiveness. So it's no longer able to combat illnesses, particularly pernicious diseases and ailments like cancer. And AIDS also stems directly from the fluoridated water. Most of your AIDS victims came from large cities which had been the first to fluoridate their water. So
because of the immune system, it made it more
immune
susceptible?
System, more susceptible to AIDS. Now, the AIDS virus supposedly attacks the immune system, but the immune system has already been under attack for a long time from the person who's been drinking fluoridated water. So really what has happened when you get HIV virus is that it attacks an already weakened immune system. And so this is the real explanation of AIDS, and not because a little green monkey supposedly got together with a woman in the heart of Africa in some village, and suddenly everybody came down with AIDS all over the world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the drug trust figures, tell them anything, they'll swallow it, because we've got the media, and we tell them this.
Well, we've been swallowing enough drugs for a long time.
Well, we have indeed, yes.
Yeah, it's like we have been perpetually drugged over the last 50 years, regardless.
But the drug trust and the Rockefellers, their treatment for cancer is called the cut, slash, and burn technique of curing. And, of course, it's sure death. It's a slow death. I mean, it's like the old Indians, you know, when they would capture you on the frontier in the early days of this country, and they would stake you out and torture you for 4 or 5 days or as long as you could last. Well, the doctors do the same thing when they diagnose cancer. That means you're in for a really long period of torture until you finally succumb.
What about the Cancer Society itself? I mean, people give a lot of money to the Cancer Society. Is that beneficial for them to do so?
Well, they have these annual cancer drives in which the people in all the small towns of America are forced to go out and collect money for the American Cancer Society, and I describe that as the little people collecting money for the big rich. Mm-hmm. American Cancer Society is a big rich organization, and if you remember that it was founded at the Union League Club in New York City, the wealthiest club in New York, by John D. Rockefeller Jr. Mm-hmm. See, John D. Rockefeller Jr. was a great philanthropist, and he said, we're going to do something about cancer, so I am founding and I'm putting up the money for the American Cancer Society. See, the Rockefeller family has had a long-term commitment to cancer. See, the founder of the dynasty, old John D.'s father, William Rockefeller, was a carnival sideshow barker who sold bottles of mineral oil for $5 a piece, and he advertised himself as the great cancer specialist. And so he sold these all up and down through Pennsylvania and Ohio when he wasn't running from the law, because he also was a very famous horse thief, and he also had 18 warrants out against him for rape. So just a very colorful character. And so John D. Rockefeller, his son, was just the opposite, because he was so horrified by his father's escapades, that he led a very bourgeois life, very quiet, very good family life, and devoted himself to making money. But he found out that at least his father had one asset, and that was that making money through cancer cures was a surefire thing. So the Rockefeller family today is the dynasty which is behind all the cancer treatment in the United States through the Sloan Kettering Cancer Mausoleum of New York City.
Well, what would you do, Eustace, if one of your very, very close relatives or friends had cancer? Would you just, where do you go? Do you go to the hospital? Do you have a checkup, or do you eat apricot juice, or what?
Well, I have a relative who has cancer, has had it for 5 years. And unfortunately, he went the whole route. First, he had 25 radiation treatments. Then he had 34 chemotherapy treatments, and and the cancer spread to his bones, because none of these things do anything to stop the cancer. It causes you a lot of misery, but it doesn't really affect the cancer. So he's had quite a difficult time of it.
Do you mean to tell me that chemotherapy really doesn't help, or can it help, or can't? I mean, is there any way? I mean, what about radical? What about surgery? And you're saying that there's no way. Cancer, I mean, if you cut the area that's cancerous out, doesn't it have a stopping action? Or?
Well, you'll see feature stories in the press constantly where some individual somewhere, they found somebody who did have cancer and who had this treatment, and so now they proudly announce the cancer is in total remission. In other words, there is no cancer there. And unfortunately, this is what the medical monopoly itself calls anecdotal medicine. In other words, you tell a story about something that happened to your grandfather or your nephew or somebody, and that it was the cancer went into remission. But there's absolutely no scientific basis for any of these claims. And the story that the medical monopoly puts out is this person was diagnosed as having cancer, and they went to the hospital, and they had radiation or chemotherapy, and the cancer went into remission, and they've lived happily ever after. But there again, you have absolutely no way of evaluating this hype, which is in the media.
I want to personally thank one of America's number one patriots, Mr. Eustace Mullins, for his courage in being able to author a book of such significance in the face of the dynasties, the syndicates, and the anti-middle class establishment. Eustace, I thank you so much for being with us today. God bless you, and I want you back on the Bobby Lee Show soon.
Thank you, Bobby Lee. I'll look forward to it.
That was an interview with Eustace Mullins on the Bobby Lee Show about his book, Murder by Injection, The Story of Medical Conspiracy Against America. The book was published in 1988. We now hear part of an hour-long lecture by Eustace Mullins about his book, Rape of Justice, America's Tribunals Exposed, and part of the foreword in this book, Rape of Justice, reads, "Americans recognize that we must have laws and abide by them, otherwise life would become intolerable. The problem is that law-abiding citizens are usually greeted in courts with disbelief that anyone still obeys the laws in this nation, and two, that a legal system which is operated by and for criminals has no greater enemy than the law-abiding citizen. The first purpose of law has always been salus populi, the safety of the people. I write this in a building which has five locks on every door. This situation has been created not by the negligence of the police, who are working harder than ever, but by the legal system, which abruptly denied the previous basis of our legal system, salus populi, in 1933 with the advent of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who adopted the Marxist concept that the legal system was being used unfairly to defend property. Because of the communist decree that all property was now the property of the state, the legal system need no longer defend crimes against personal property. This was soon extended to crimes against persons. The doctrine of compulsory equality meant that no citizen was entitled to wear a gold watch or to live in a large home. Other citizens who wished to deprive them of their excess property, even at the cost of their lives, were looked upon with approval by the legal system if they injured or killed too many citizens in their exuberance. They might be confined for a short time, but they were soon released to continue the Marxist campaign of leveling, that is, of reducing all citizens to a common level of fear and despair." Let's listen now to part of this lecture by Eustace Mullins about his book, Rape of Justice, America's Tribunals Exposed.
Oh. Your hand. Oh, I'm sorry.
All righty, you're on.
All right. Now, the history of law in the United States is very interesting because it was a very simple profession up to 1900. You only had one law book in the United States. It was called Kent's Commentaries. And it covered everything, and that's the only law book that lawyers needed to know. And there weren't many law schools. Most people read law in another lawyer's office. And all you'd do is sit there and read Kent's Commentaries and go with the lawyer to court and see how he argued his motion and so forth. So that all changed in 1900. And what happened was, with the Eastern European immigration, the American law courts switched over, and I'm sure the Canadian courts too, they switched over from this very simple, basic law to Talmudic law. Now, Talmudic law comes from the Kehillah, and it's a totally different ball of wax. Has nothing to do with human rights, has nothing to do with justice. It's simply a mechanized system for imposing the will of the court on the litigants. And that's all it does. It imposes the will of the court. And that's why they brought in the process of discovery, that you had to turn over all your papers to the other side, total violation of the Constitution, and totally illegal, because what they would do is try the case through discovery. In other words, the opposing lawyer would go through your private papers, pick out what he could use against you, and go to court with that, and he would have a very good case. So the jury never got to hear the evidence. In fact, I gave due notice to the court in Massachusetts, where I have a case going for 10 years. I do a lot of civil rights cases because, you know, I'm standing here talking before you. This doesn't happen very often because a lot of times when I am going to give a lecture, And they announce it in the, and on the radio and the papers and so forth. By the time I get there, a couple of days later, someone has organized a tremendous campaign to prevent me from speaking. The lecture hall has been taken away. There's always a front page newspaper story denouncing me, you know. And because I am pretty dangerous. Jed Hoover called me the most dangerous man in America. Because I was dangerous to him. He was absolutely right. But I wasn't dangerous to anybody else. And never have been. But he really considered me a real threat. And the strange thing was that during the years that I was, that Jed Hoover had me under daily surveillance for 33 years, I spent all of my time in Washington at the home of a high FBI official, who was an old friend and great admirer. He was also a great admirer of Jed Hoover. He thought he was a great guy. But finally, they called this guy in and they said, well, of course, we know that your friend Eustace has been staying at your house. And he was only about 8 months from retirement. And they said, if you let him back in your house once more, you will never see your pension. And the guy didn't have that kind of money. He needed his pension to retire on. So he asked me to meet him downtown, just beyond the Justice Building. And he said, Eustace, I've got some awful news. I said, what? He said, well, they've told me that I must break off all contact with you until I retire. And he was so shamefaced, because he was a very honorable person, he was so shamefaced about this. I said, well, H.E., don't feel bad about that. I said, this is not your decision, someone else's decision, I understand that, and I certainly don't criticize you for it. And so he was very relieved, and I said goodbye, and I didn't contact him until he retired. And after he retired, I went back to staying at his house because he was getting his pension, everything was taken care of. But this is the kind of bureaucratic dictatorship that you have in Washington. Total subservience to, it's like military discipline, really. You cannot criticize your superiors. You cannot go over the head of your superiors. Your whole career is passed under this discipline, and at no time can you ever go beyond it. If you do what they call the whistleblowers, if you become a whistleblower, you become immediately the most hated person in the area. Like Ted Gunderson told me yesterday, he was kicked out of the Association of Retired FBI Agents, which all FBI agents belong to, and which is considered a very good society to be in. And they're proud of being FBI agents, and they're proud of being members. They kicked him out because he criticized some things the FBI had done. And so that's no reflection on him, that's a reflection on them. And I think he told you, too, standing here, that his former associates in the FBI were spreading rumors that he was homosexual, that he had embezzled money, and so forth. This is standard procedure. They do this. In fact, at one point in my 800 pages, they stated that I had homosexual tendencies. What they were, I have no idea because they didn't elaborate, you see. But so I'm still in the dark on that. But the worst thing that they said against me in the 800 pages was that Eustace Mullins is a very sloppy dresser. That cost them $2 million to find that out. All they had to do was find out I bought all my clothes at thrift shops, and of course they don't usually fit well. They don't look that good. They're okay. Now, they'll keep you warm, but they don't look that good. And they used to take pictures of me. I'd be walking through a yard, and somebody would jump out of the bushes and take pictures. So I figured, well, this is my publicity agent. You know, I can't complain. So they had lots of pictures of me. They always had my current license plate file. They say Eustace Mullins, 49 Plymouth, license so and so. And I'm sure they thought that I was a real sort of intelligence agent myself, or an espionage agent, because I had a Virginia driver's license, and I lived in Chicago, and I had a Kentucky license plate. Well, the reason I had a Kentucky license plate was you could get a license plate in Kentucky for $3 through the mail, and in Chicago they were $15. So it was simply a matter of saving $12. I mean, I had no particular association with Kentucky. So anyway, I finally pretty well straightened out things with the FBI because I went to court and got my judgments against them. And after that, they pretty well let me alone because the bureaucrats don't like to lose. And I had trouble with the IRS for years, and they would call me in for an audit and that sort of thing, and then they would say I owed a couple $100. So finally, I went to U.S. Tax Court, and all of my friends would tell me, don't go to U.S. Tax Court because the judges are all ex-IRS agents. So I went on to U.S. Tax Court, and well, first I sued the IRS because I got a notice from the IRS that they were calling me in for an audit and to bring all of my papers down to the IRS office. And so I read this over, and I thought, well, this is a very frightening thing. It's really terrifying. So I filed suit against the agent for $350,000 for terrorism. Well, nobody had ever done this. So the district director of the IRS, he immediately told my friends, he said, they asked him, his cousin took him out to dinner, and she said, and she was a friend of mine, she said, what's this about Mullins suing you? He said, oh, everybody knows Mullins is crazy anyway, so don't pay any attention to it. We don't pay any attention to it. Well, they finally ruled that I had a tax deficiency after about a year. And meanwhile, I had filed motions before the court to suspend all income tax collections in the United States until they decided the very important legal points that I had brought up. Well, they didn't want to suspend income tax collections, so they didn't do it. And I thought this was a logical thing to do because if they're stealing from me, why should they continue to steal from everybody? I'm a very sympathetic person. I like to help other people. I thought, just let everybody stop paying taxes till we resolve this situation. It's a legal matter anyway. So they didn't agree, and finally a federal judge ruled that I had a tax deficiency, so I immediately filed with U.S. Tax Court. And I was corresponding with the lawyers from the IRS. The head lawyer of the IRS assigned all the papers to me, Malcolm B. Morton. So after about a year of corresponding, finally we were scheduled to appear in tax court, and I thought, well, now I'm going to finally meet Malcolm B. Morton and see what kind of a guy he is. Well, when I went to tax court, I looked around and there was nobody there. The IRS would not send anybody into court against me because I had filed a stipulation with the tax court judge that I wanted the IRS charged with conspiring to put me in a mental institution because in my FBI file, they had papers that J. Edgar Hoover had ordered my income tax returns from the IRS and so forth, which showed conspiracy. So they weren't about to get into that, so when we went in, and the judge was a very stern-looking guy, and he called the case Mullins versus Internal Revenue Service. And I stood up, and I said, Your Honor, I said, before we begin the case, I think we should review the stipulations that I have before the court. And he looked at me and said, Mr. Mullins, this court does not have time to go into all that. And, of course, I already knew there was no IRS lawyer, and they had a little U.S. attorney there, a young guy. And he said, I want you, an attorney so-and-so, to go into a conference room, and I want you to work this out. So I said, okay. And so we went into a conference room, and I had prepared a long list of my expenses, gasoline and meals and so forth, over the last 3 years. And I'd done it in all different color pencils and inks and so forth, different pieces of paper and all this. So it looked very good. So he looked at all this. I worked at it, you know. I want to do things right. And so the U.S. attorney looked at all this. And he said, well, he said, actually, he said, your deductions do exceed your tax deficiency. And I didn't have one receipt or anything for all that. All I had was these papers that I had scrawled the night before, sitting while I was watching television. So, we came back out before the tax court judge, and he said, "Have you gentlemen reached a decision?" And we said, "Yes, we have." And he said, "What is your decision?" And the attorney said, "Well, we have found that Mr. Mullins has no tax deficiency." So I walked out of that court with a signed letter from the U.S. tax court judge that I had no tax deficiency. I reprinted it in a couple of my books. It's in Writ for Martyrs and it's in Rape of Justice. And that was in 82, and I have never heard from the IRS since. And so people ask me when I lecture, say, Eustace, what do you do about your taxes? How do you handle paying taxes? I say, well, I pay anything I owe. But I've never heard from them that I owe anything. So I said, they never call. So I'm not hiding. I'm in the phone book, and but they never call. It's a little disappointing in a way. But I mention this simply to show you, after all, as I say, I'm not a lawyer. I have no legal training except what I've undergone myself. But appearing in court is the greatest legal training in the world. Because they're going to throw everything at you that they have, and you either win or lose. Mostly I've won. Like I say, I have my default judgments. They don't bother me anymore. And I do give legal consultations to other people. I tell people, call me anytime. People call me up and ask me about legal problems. And my friends say, well, you don't know who you're talking to. Those are probably agents. And I said, they probably are, but I don't care. And I give them the information, and they can do with it what they want. But like I say, civil procedure is so simple. You only have to do three things. You deny everything, and you answer everything. And as long as you do that, you stay in court. That's it. I just gave you a whole law course. But the last few years, I've done a lot of civil rights cases because I say I've been denied freedom of speech and the right to speak many times. And I had a friend named Bo Greitz who has a radio program, and he went up to Cape Cod, and he came back and he said, Eustace, there's a bunch of guys up there, and one of them owns a chain of restaurants. He said, I was up there and I was wined and dined, champagne, the works. He said, you ought to go up there. I said, well, it sounds very tempting. So I contacted these guys, and sure enough, they said, come on up and speak. So they put out flyers, they called themselves the Freedom Forum, and I was to speak at a Greek Orthodox church. The Greeks, of course, are very prosperous up there. They have restaurants and they have lots of money. And they built this enormous, beautiful church, which had a lecture room. So they put out the flyers. So then the newspaper attacked. Cape Cod Time did a front page story on the notorious conspirator who's going to speak in Centerville, Massachusetts, which is the next town from the Kennedy compound. And so So they put pressure on the priest to deny me speaking there. And the priest said, I can't do it. It's a commitment. We've already agreed, and I have no grounds to stop it. So they got desperate, and they started calling him up and saying they were going to blow up the building if he allowed me to speak there. And, of course, under that pressure, he caved in, and he announced to the paper that I would not be speaking. So I sued the Cape Cod Times, and when I sued the Cape Cod Times, I realized that it was owned by Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal. So I sued the Dow Jones Corporation in Virginia. There was a Dow Jones Corporation in Virginia. Well, we went before a federal judge in Virginia, and he said, Mr. Mullins, I have no jurisdiction over this. This is a newspaper in Massachusetts. And so what do you want me to do? And I said, well, I'll sue under jurisdiction. So he moved the case up to Massachusetts. And so my suit against Dow Jones Corporation went right to Massachusetts, Barnstable, Massachusetts. And so they had no intention of ever hearing the case. So they finally dismissed it. And so then I reopened it, because you can always reopen a case. I reopened a case recently that had been summary judgment against me a couple of years ago. Lawyers' responses to pleadings are absolutely primitive. They usually have no logic, and it's just like a fit of temper. Darn it, I'm not going to let you do that. That's the whole idea, you know. And they're so incompetent when it comes to matters of law. They seem to have no respect for law, but of course, being a Freemason lodge, they don't have to have any logic to what they do. So I eventually had three civil rights cases dismissed in Massachusetts. So I sent due notice to the court, and I pointed out that I had had three civil rights cases dismissed in Massachusetts, denial of jury trial in each one. So I still got one going on, because one case where they got summary judgment against me, I refiled against three other people who were involved. I knew the judge was going to rule against me in a few weeks. So I hastily wrote a complaint against three other defendants who were involved, who had not been mentioned in the original case, and drove up there and filed it with the court when it opened at 9 o'clock in the morning. And so after they filed a summary judgment against the Berkshire Eagle case, then I still had the case against these other people. And so then I amended that complaint. I developed cancer, by the way, and I amended my complaint to include the fact that they had caused me to have cancer by all the terrible stresses that they had subjected me to, and that cancer was caused by stress. Well, let's put the lawyers into orbit. They'd never heard an argument like this in their life. And that's still going on. And now the judge has taken it under advisement, which means he's absolutely terrified and doesn't know what to do. When a judge takes a case under advisement, it means you won't hear from him for at least a year or maybe 2 years. And so I just get busy with other things, you know. You don't sit around waiting for the judge to do something. You get to file some other suit. I got a couple of others. On July the 2nd, my hometown newspaper there in Stanton, Virginia, interviewed me. And they called and said, we want to interview you about Revelation Books. Revelation Books is an imprint under which I published The Curse of Canaan in 1985. It was totally inactive. And so they listed me as one of the leading hate groups in the United States, Revelation Books. So this girl called me up and said, I'd like to interview you about Revelation Books. And I was totally mystified. What was there to say about Revelation Books? Well, she brought in this report from an outfit called Southern Poverty Law Center, which claimed that I was one of the leading hate groups in the United States. That is, Revelation Books was, not Eustace Mullins. So I very patiently explained to her that this was all untrue, that there was no hate group, and there was no members, no newsletter, and it was a Christian publishing company, which was inactive. And so she went away, and I thought they would never print it, because there was nothing to print. Well, they came out with a front page story, and a lot of stuff from Southern Poverty Law Center that I had been lecturing before all of the leading hate groups in the United States, listing none of them, because there weren't any. I mean, this is the only hate group I've been at lately. You'll probably be called a hate group after I've been here, because... But the guy that ran the Southern Poverty Law Center is a guy named Morris Deese, and he has been so successful, he has raised $500 million cash from suckers through promotions that he's going to fight hate. And, you know, fighting hate is not that hard. You just go out and fight it. And you might have to spend $500 million, but at least you're doing something worthwhile, you know. So I wrote an expose of him about 4 years ago, and what Morris Deese was doing was counterattacking me for writing this expose. Because, of course, he never answered anything. Because what I did, I found his court papers in his divorce. And in the court papers, his wives said that he had urged them to go out and have sex with everybody because he wanted to get rid of them so they wouldn't claim his $500 million. And then he also was caught in bed with a homosexual. He just wanted to try it, apparently. And this is all court documents that I'm quoting, see. So this was all published and circulated over the United States. And Morris Deese never answered, but he bided his time, and he was going to lay it on me, and he did with this article. So this is actually one of the most blatant attacks on me yet, that I lecture before recognized hate groups, that I have a hate group myself, and which is non-existent. So when I get back, of course, I'll be filing more lawsuits. I'm going to sue for $9 million and $9 million punitive. I always sue for punitive damages because After all, you suffer a lot when they lay this stuff on you, and mental anguish and suffering is something that has to be atoned for. I have a lot of mental anguish. I may not look it, but... But what I have done is show up the legal system for the totally inconsistent and ridiculous charade that it is. And here the judges and lawyers have been bringing people in for years and stripping them of everything they had. And they also, by the way, for people like myself, they have a special punishment called attorney's fees. And I sued the city of Stanton once for this accident where the guy tried to kill me. They had two black women who came to be as prospective jurors, and the lawyers for the opposition immediately shot them down and got them out of there very quickly. And because black women tend to be very generous in the judgments against insurance companies, and lawyers know this, so they hustled these two black ladies out, and they weren't on my jury. And this was the jury where they said I backed into the car and smashed in the side of my car. So, after this case was over, I sued the city for discrimination for not allowing the black women on the jury, which, you know, was a very hot issue at that time. And so we went into federal court, and of course the judge was not very sympathetic at all. But I noticed that the attorney for the city kept jumping up and saying, Your Honor, attorney's fees, attorney's fees. And the judge would look at him, and the judge was no friend of mine, but he said, no, I'm not going to award attorney's fees against Mr. Mullins. And the guy would jump up a couple minutes later, attorney's fees, attorney's fees. And he'd say, no, I'm not going to award attorney's fees. So I got to thinking, why is the judge not going to award attorney's fees against me? Because he's no friend of mine. And I finally realized that when you represent yourself, that the other side cannot assess attorney's fees against you greater than your own fees, which in my case were none. So I've been using this ever since. So if they ever want to assess attorney's fees against you and you represent yourself, you realize they cannot do it, because apparently under procedure, you cannot assess attorney's fees against a litigant which are greater than the other side's attorney's fees. And I've been writing on that ever since. You find out these things as you go along. That's why I say when you go into court, you win, because you find out things you would never know otherwise. And I've been using that, and of course, I'm using cancer, and I'm using everything, because you use what is there.
That was part of a lecture by Eustace Mullins on his book, Rape of Justice, America's Tribunals Exposed. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information.